Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life.
The reason I know you'll prevail is because so many others have done it before you.
You're likely to be world-class at whatever you obsess over. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become.
Welcome to Pixels and Properties, the only platform for busy, high-caliber tech professionals seeking financial transformation through real estate ventures. Subscribe to our complimentary weekly newsletter through the show notes to receive deep dives, expert insights, and resources to accelerate your investment journey without buying yourself another job. Ready to build wealth on your terms? Let's get started.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another podcast of Pixels and Properties. Today, I have Clint Harris with us. We are here to talk about one of my favorite topics, adaptive reuse. Clint Harris is the general partner of Nomad Capital. He got his start in medical sales before jumping in to full-time into real estate. He and his team buys big box retail and converts them to self-storage facilities. He has raised capital for over $90 million in stabilized assets. I cannot wait to dive in with you, Clint. Is there anything else that you'd like to share in your background?
First of all, thanks for having me. Very excited to be here. We connected a while back, and I'm excited to be a part of what y'all are doing. So, yeah, you got most of it. That's pretty much the gist of it, right? I spent 16 years in medical sales, cardiology, implanting pacemakers and defibrillators. Mm-hmm. The way that I looked at it, I love my job. I was lucky to be pretty good at my job, but it's kind of a young man's game. And so, in that space, you're kind of always looking ahead as to what the off ramp's going to look like. You know, I didn't. A lot of people go into management and kind of stick with that for an entire career. I've always been pretty entrepreneurial and really enjoyed real estate. So my wife and I started building a real estate portfolio outside of that, just with an eye towards the future. Kind of one of those things you don't, you know, wait for it to start raining before you build Noah's Ark, right? You kind of want to plan ahead for that scenario. So through that process, we built a small portfolio of 14 Airbnb properties, which turned into a property management company and kind of created a lot of options for us in terms of what our future was going to look like in the medical space. And then that was a very, very active real estate investing strategy. So from there, pivoted to investing into self-storage because I found it to be a very passive investment strategy. And then that moved forward through joint venture into syndication, and then eventually kind of retired myself out of medical sales to do full-time syndication, buying big box retail, converting it to self-storage.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, Clint, and really, it could probably go for five different episodes. Maybe we make this into a five-part series. And I do want to unpack each of those elements. But before we even dive in, I saw that one of your mantras is financial independence is shallow. Independence of purpose is the goal. Can you expand on that?
Yes, absolutely. Man, that just like cuts to the core of, yeah, there's a lot to talk about here, but you know, I come from a line of work where you're doing surgery, and I would get paid when I did an implant, put a pacemaker defibrillator in, and then that was my patient for the rest of their life. And I would see them in clinic and everything else. But the way that I was reimbursed was just when we did surgery. And at the end of the day, you're trading time for money, as most people in life and in their occupation are. And even in a lot of real estate, if you're a real estate agent or you're a wholesaler or you're a house flipper, at the end of the day, you're trading time for money. And the reality is everybody's looking for some form of financial freedom, or that's the buzzword. That's what everybody's talking about. But I've seen people get to financial freedom, and I've reached a level of it myself, but when it came with a very highly active investment portfolio that I still had to manage or manage the people that were managing, the ultimate realization for me is that financial freedom by itself is shallow. That's not the goal. The goal should be financial independence combined with time independence and location independence, because those three things together mean that you can go where you want, when you want, do what you want, and you have the time and the means to do it. It creates an independence of purpose. And the independence of purpose is where you decide what is important to you in your life, whether it's spending time with your family or traveling or skiing or working or, you know, hunting or fishing or whatever it may be, you know, hopefully doing something to better yourself, better your family, better your community. But whatever that means for you, you have the freedom to do that. And a lot of people that hit that financial freedom, if they're locked in one location or they have to spend a certain amount of time in front of a screen every day, I think that we miss on what the independence of purpose can really look like. People that haven't gotten there kind of have an idea of what they would do if they were financially independent. But what you don't think about is the time or location implications. So I think it can be bigger than that. It's the independence of purpose. And I think along the way to getting there, people need to be figuring out what they would do with that purpose.
Did you realize that when you were in medical sales, or was it something that you realized after you had achieved financial independence? Was this something that you always had that, you know, kind of wisdom that carried you and informed your decisions, or is it something that you kind of learned the hard way?
It's a great question. I think it's something that I learned. There definitely was a point where we hit financial freedom while I was still doing my job, and I loved my job and I was good at my job. And part of that career comes with you're a very small part of a big machine, but that machine is saving lives. Like I said, tiny little part of it. And I don't want that to sound like I was more important than I was, but there's something that comes with that. It's a really satisfying feeling of when you're making a difference for individuals and for their families and for their communities. So because of that, there's a sense of purpose that comes with that, and leaving that behind, honestly, was a little bit hard, which I think most of that, it just speaks to ego that in myself. But once you got to the point of it, there's a change when you go from you have a job that you have to do because you need the financial stability. When you get to the point that you don't need it for that reason anymore and you're doing it because it's a choice, there's a little bit of a difference in the attitude when you're getting in ready for work in the morning and you're driving to the hospital at 5:30 in the morning. When it's a choice, it's a really, really good feeling. That doesn't mean that there doesn't come a time when it's time for you to do something else and there's an off-ramp there. But I think that transition of getting closer to financial independence puts you in a position where, oh, wow, you know what? I don't have to do this, but I get to do this, or I choose to do this. Mm-hmm. What am I going to choose to do when it's not this? Those questions kind of come along the way.
That is so well articulated. I feel like, and this comes up actually repeatedly on this podcast, that, you know, there's this narrative that's been formed, which is so anti W-2, get out of your day job and then be free. But, you know, there are many people who do have careers like the ones that you did, where you were making an impact on other people's lives. And look, if that's something that is a driving value to that person, right? Like then it's not necessarily that real estate and the day job are mutually exclusive. It can actually be a very powerful tool to fill your cup or your needs as it relates to financial needs, while you are getting the sense of purpose through your skill sets or through your expertise that you've developed in the day job. And so I guess the mantra there is that you don't have to run away from your day job. If anything, investing in real estate can actually make it so that you're working because you want to, not because you have to. And so I think, yeah, thank you for sharing that, Clint. Have you felt that the skill sets that you developed as a medical sales professional have helped propel your career in real estate? And how did that evolve over time, right? Like, were there certain aspects of your medical sales career that were helping your early days efforts when it was a portfolio of Airbnb properties, less so or more so than what you're doing today? I think that's another area where many folks who do have, you know, a work at a large tech company or another form of, you know, high income profession, but they think that, hey, what do I know about real estate? How could I, you know, how can my skill sets translate? So I would love for you to be able to share how your skill sets actually that you developed as an employee have actually helped bolster your effort, your career as a real estate investor.
Sure. There's a lot of overlap there, specifically starting out. Like I was a medical sales rep, and when you're in sales, basically your job is to go around and have people tell you no all the time, right? And especially I worked in pacemakers and defibrillators. You're selling to electrophysiologists, which are a very specialized section of cardiologists. They're highly intelligent people that I was always the dumbest guy in the room. But when you're surrounded by those people, you learn how to speak with them, and you learn what their thought process is and kind of how to navigate that. So in terms of the developing thick skin through sales, when it came to building out our own portfolio, most of our first, we have, it's 14 doors, but it's only four properties. It's four quadplexes and a duplex, three of which we got off market. And so in terms of cold calling, knocking on doors, sending letters, picking up the phone, anything like that, driving for dollars. The first ways we picked up those properties through rental arbitrage before we had a lot of money to invest and things like that. Yeah, those sales skills come into play, and it's use what you got, right? If you're tech savvy, there's probably a lot more intuitive and natural ways to get that done in terms of building lists and sorting those lists and sending out communications with those people. I'm a kind of get it done, grab it, and go kind of person, because that's what I've had to do for my career. You kind of rise, kill, and eat, and every month you start over at zero, right? So that played into just, in my opinion, this is not my words, it's one of my partners, but risk is a muscle, you know, and the more that you kind of work some of those risk muscles, the stronger they get and the higher your tolerance is for risk. Obviously, understanding the difference between risk and calculated risk, but that certainly helped me. And then as we move forward through building a short-term rental portfolio, that turned into building a property management company with 85 listings. We brought on some great operating partners that run that. That turned into a linen facility with 30 to 40,000 pounds of linens a month during the summer. That turns into golf cart rentals. It kind of spun out of control a little bit. It got big. And that's what really pushed us into making a move into a significantly more passive investment strategy, which is self-storage facilities, and then specifically into syndication. And the same skill set that I had in sales is what pushed me forward there. Most of our early investors into our syndication deals of going and buying a 80 or 90,000 square foot Kmart and converting it to 600 or 700 units of Class A climate controlled self-storage, they were pretty much all my cardiologists that were my buddies, right? These were my friends because, you know, white coat professionals, very much like IT professionals on the West Coast or active military that's deployed or, you know, small business owners that may have sold a business for 5 to 10 million. Like, they all have capital, but a lot of them don't have time. Without time, you can't get experience. So the idea is that, you know, with real estate investing, you have to have those three things. It's time, it's experience, and money. So those people with their capital can invest it with other people in their time and experience that have the ability to make sure that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts and it has success. So the skill sets that I had from that was obviously the relationships came into play for the first one or two deals. Outside of that, raising capital to date around $15 million I got to change my numbers on my biography. We're about $120 million in assets under management. You burn through those, you know, work through the people that you know fairly quickly, and you have to get out to the periphery. But in terms of the white coat community, I speak the language. They're all looking for opportunity like that. I know how to go through the sales process with those, and just, it's honestly not a sales process. It's just education. This is what we're doing. If it fits in with what you're looking for, that's great. If it doesn't, that's fine too. We'll be over here doing it. So I think that two things that you bring up is a really good point. No matter what your skill set is, there's a way that it can apply specifically to real estate and real estate investing, because it's a very broad subject matter. There's a million different things that you can do. And then, so that's like the number one thing. And then on top of that is the purpose that we talked about earlier. I don't want to make my job sound like more important than it was, but what I found is that since I got out of that and I'm into full-time as a real estate investor, you can find that purpose in anything that you do. You can do anything with an attitude to try to do the best you can for yourself, your friends, the people around you, and you're helping other people in a lot of different ways. It really was ego. And I think I was a little bit prideful about what I did at the time until later I realized, like, you know what? It doesn't matter what you do from, you know, you can be a garbage man or a doctor or anything. Like, if you do it with an attitude of helping people, you can find that purpose in anything. I think that's really important. That's something that I'm 41 years old, you know, and I've been a full-time real estate investor for a little over a year now. And I'm ashamed to say that it took me that long to kind of realize that like most people can bring that attitude to everything they do every day. I think that's something that I should have learned a lot earlier.
You talk about how it was ego that, you know, may have been the reason why, you know, what made it harder to make that jump. But I also wonder how much of it was, you know, just your colleagues at work, right? Like, was it, or what you thought your colleagues at work would think of you if you left that safe career path? Did you share your journey? Did you share with your friends or your how much did you share with your friends and colleagues is really what I should ask about what it was that you were working on the side as you were also being a medical sales professional?
Yeah. So obviously you have to be a little bit careful about that, right? Like, one of the things about, you know, being in sales is you always want to look like you need the business, right? You don't drive a flashy car. You don't have the big house, or if you do, you know, you probably won't be doing it for long. So yeah, within reason, but in that industry, like most of the physicians that I work with are, those were my closest friends in my peer group. So yeah, over time, like we fish together, we dive together, we go offshore, whatever, like we're talking and people found out, what was happening, but obviously, you know, within reason, I was pretty quiet about things in terms of social media and things like that. But then one day you wake up and you're like, okay, we just converted a Kmart to self-storage and I made 4 times what I've ever made in my best year in medical sales. Maybe it's time to start thinking about something a little bit different. But it's always daunting when, you know, that career is, it's got a really high ceiling, but it's got a ceiling. And so I think for me, and I don't know if I'm speaking to anybody else or if I'm just kind of blabbing about where my mind was, if you know what the ceiling is of what you're currently doing, right? And it can be a high ceiling, but if you know what that is, the question you have to ask yourself is this enough for my family? And not just with money, but with time and location independence and everything else. Is that ceiling enough? And if you decide, or for me, when I decided for myself that it wasn't enough, then the only real risk is not doing something, right? I mean, it takes a long time to kind of earn to that position where you're in medical sales, but you're not doing like total joints where somebody's in the door and then out the door and you never see them again. Like, these are my patients for life. I have relationships with the doctors, relationships with the patients. It typically has a high ceiling and good long-term stability. But if you make the decision that that ceiling is not enough for you, your family, and what you want out of life, then the only real risk is not doing something. And because then you're setting yourself up for like I would like to live in a way that I minimize future regret, if that makes sense.
That is gold. Thank you for sharing that. I've never heard of it shared that eloquently. So it's clearly something that you've thought long and hard about, but that was very well said. So I guess then your biggest regret during that phase is not making that jump earlier. But would you agree with that? Or were there other mistakes that you know, going back, you know, you feel like if you had done something a little bit, done it in a slightly different way, or would you have done it any differently, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
I think that everything happens for a reason, and the timing on this, believe it or not, of course, I wish it had happened as a younger man because I would have had a longer runway. That having been said, everything happened for a reason. Most of the good things that have happened to me in life are because of relationships. It's because I'm a natural driven extrovert. I like to meet people and just figure out what they're up to and look for ways to help. So it all happened very naturally for me. When I made that transition, the reality was I've been pretty hardcore investing into self-storage and things bigger than multifamily and Airbnbs for 1.5 to 2 years. So it made that transition pretty easy. I don't think it could have gotten much easier. And it's not a testament to me. It's a testament to the partners that I have and the timeline of, you know, reading the tea leaves and kind of making that jump at the right time. So I think we all have some level of regret about, man, if I'd known about this 10 years ago, it would have meant so much more to me in the long run. But at the same time, like I've got a 4-year-old son and I've got a 7-month-old son, and I take my 4-year-old to school every morning. I pick him up every afternoon. I am present for the birth of this child so much differently than I was 4 years ago for my first son. Like that day, I did 3 surgeries that day, running back and forth from one end of the hospital to the other, where this time it was like I was home for months. So I think things happen for a reason. You can always look for a reason why you wish they had happened differently. But mine's just a reflection on the people that I know and the things that I learned around the process. I think you can look at a real estate investor's lifestyle and whatever avenue that they choose. My job is to try to fast forward that. See, what does that look like? Like real quick, like if you take a young person wants to get into real estate investing, a lot of times he'll do wholesaling. He or she will do wholesaling because they don't have any money. They're trading time for money. Well, fast forward a couple of years, they figured out they're passing on some good deals. They start flipping some houses. Fast forward a couple of years, they realize they're only getting paid once. When they wholesale or flip a house, they're trading time for money. The day they stop working is the day they stop getting paid. So then they start holding some single families. Then they realize a couple of years later that that's exhausting and they get into multifamily. Then they realize that you really have to get into big multifamily and have an on-site manager to make it worth it. Then they realize they want to get their time back. And so they start investing into other people's multifamily. And eventually they end up in syndication. And the old dudes, or men or women, highly successful people that look like they're sitting around to do nothing, are usually doing one of 3 things. It's hard money lending, mobile home parks, or self-storage. At least in my community, that's what I found. My job, no matter what strategy is look at the highly successful people that have been doing it a long time and where do they land? And let's go there. Like, let's, you know what I mean? Like, but I spent all this time bouncing back and forth and learning, and everybody should do that. You should learn along the way. But if, you know, if you can pick of what the destination looks like and work backwards from there, you know, if you're sailing across the ocean, you can be off by 1,000 miles if you just steer 1 or 2 degrees in one direction or the other. So I try to look at the people that I want to emulate, and my journey is going to look differently. But if I know what the destination looks like, sometimes it helps me backtrack and figure out the best way to get there.
Yeah, it's, real estate is one of the oldest games, you know, in human civilization. And why reinvent the wheel? So many people have gone through this process. I think you say, well, why not just click the fast forward button and skip all those other steps that everybody else has gone through when you can just, you know, go to where everybody ends up landing anyway. I think that that's very wise. You know, one of the things that you also just touched on is, yeah, you're a lot more present for your current child and or for your younger child than your older child. And, you know, for those who are in corporate jobs today that are trying to get started with real estate, like, but are struggling to balance the two. And I feel like you kind of just alluded to this a moment ago. You know, what advice would you share for those folks? You know, is it serious? Is it just, you know, you just have to, you have to make a trade-off somewhere. Maybe you sleep a little bit less. Maybe you spend a little bit more time, or you get educated, or, you know, what would you say to those folks?
So not necessarily. This is a really great question. And obviously everybody's a little bit different. I think the first thing you have to do is take a little bit of a self inventory and see, what do I have, right? What are we working with? You know, if you're on a deserted island, the first thing you want to do is kind of lay out the tools and see what you got. And like, if most people, I think these days, especially the high, you know, income professionals, probably don't have a lot of time. Without time, it's really hard to get experience. And in terms of, if you're going to go out and invest in like single family homes or even duplexes or anything like that, what you really need to do is look and see, what are you worth, right? And what are you willing to take on for yourself? Like, if you're going to rent, you know, buy 1 or 2 rental properties and manage it yourself, and you're going to be responsible for handling the management or going over and fixing a toilet or whatever, like, if you're worth $150, $200, $300 an hour, then every time that you do something yourself instead of hiring a plumber, you're really just losing money instead of just focusing on keeping the main thing, keep your sanity, focus on your family. The reality is, like, if you look at anything like that and you have to manage it yourself to make it a good deal, like, it's a terrible deal. You shouldn't do that. The bigger thing, in my opinion, is focus on, what are you really trying to accomplish? Again, is it financial freedom? Okay, that's great. Now work backwards from that number. Like, what number do you need to be your net to bring home every year? And then on average, how much time is it going to take you to get there? I think if you're making more than $250,000 a year, which it's a shame to say is not much money these days, but if you're making more than $250,000, $300,000 a year, you probably shouldn't be doing anything actively yourself. At that point in time, it's probably a much better scenario for you to take your capital and partner with someone else and let them do it for you. And there's a couple different ways you could do that. You could joint venture with someone on a business. I think the wisest thing to do is look at alternative investment strategies. And again, full disclosure, I'm a general partner. I'm a limited partner. I have retirement funds that I've pulled out of the market. Retirement was supposed to be a 3-legged stool. It was a 401k, Social Security, and pensions. Well, Social Security's not going to be there when I need it. Pensions are typically not around, and I don't believe a 401k is going to stand on its own. So I've closed out my retirement funds. I'm not allowed to invest that into our deals because I'm a general partner. It's called commingling. But I do invest it into other alternative investment strategies, multifamily apartments and syndication, self-storage syndication in Texas and other places where companies take that capital. I am partnered with them. They run the show. They do everything. I'm a limited partner. I sit back and do nothing and just watch. Outside of that, money that I have that's not in retirement, I do put into our deals, and we're a full-time operator. I raise capital from groups of investors, and then we go out, we buy big box retail, we convert it to self-storage, and they sit back and they get, you know, their job is to vet the deal, vet the operator, and after that, read the monthly, you know, newsletter and find out what's going on, and then get quarterly distributions. If you're a high income earner, that's, in my opinion, significantly better way to go. And the way that I look at it is that every time you invest into a passive investment strategy, and again, there's multiple out there, but if you're invested into a passive investment strategy, you're basically buying days off. And if you buy enough days off, you don't have to go back to work. So if you're a high income earner, I would recommend, for the most part, unless you have a highly specialized skill and you see an opportunity, if time is your most limiting resource, passive investment strategies through syndication or joint ventures with other successful professionals is probably the way to go.
Thank you for sharing that. Well, I think now it's time to dive into the adaptive reuse strategy that you'll use. So I would love if you wouldn't mind just, you know, articulating the core thesis of Nomad Capital. Then, yeah, we can kind of dive into the specifics after that.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the inverse economy use of these large big box retail spaces. If you think about it, at one point in time, there was 1,200 Kmarts across the country. And all across these secondary, tertiary markets across the country, these communities would drive to these locations. They're typically the number one employer in the community. They have great visibility, great traffic count. They're on great real estate corners right in the middle of downtown. The town typically grows around that building, basically. And then people in that community spend 20 to 30 years driving to that location to buy their home goods. Well, big box retail is dead. Amazon and Walmart have killed that space. But because of the location, the visibility, and the traffic count, it still makes great sense for those same people in that community to drive back to the same building and sometimes pay us to put the same stuff right back inside of it, right? It's the inverse flow it's unfortunate, it's sad and funny as to what it did to a lot of these towns when those buildings shut down, but now they've been sitting empty for 8, 10, 12, sometimes 15 years. So there's very little appetite for big box retail. We can go in and pick up those buildings typically for a fraction of the cost. It's a little anecdotal, but the first Kmart that we bought as a joint venture, a couple partners and I bought an 87,500 square foot Kmart for $1.5 million. Well, the replacement cost on the insurance policy that same week, if we wanted to just build that cinder block shell, is $6.5 million. So it's kind of like if you flip a house, you don't make your money when you sold it. You don't make money when you renovate it. You made your money when it smelled like dogs and cats and you bought it for dirt cheap. We look for the dog and cat buildings, right? And the way we're able to do that is we're vertically integrated. We find the buildings ourselves. We raise the capital in-house. My partners are the GCs with 35 years of commercial construction experience. So we build them out ourselves, and then we manage them ourselves for less than the going rate. So we kind of keep a lot of meat on the bone. That first Kmart that we bought for 1.5, we put 2.5 into it. So we're into it for 4. The day we cut the ribbon and opened the doors, before it was full, it appraised for 9.1. So the forced appreciation is significant. It's an asset class conversion, right? So the same way that, you know, I was buying, you know, 4-unit multifamily properties at the beach that had bad long-term tenants that were chain smoking, that hadn't had a rent increase in 12 years. I get those people out, I renovate, and I convert it to an Airbnb. The gross potential rent income goes up by 3.5 to 4X, right? So you change the asset class, it drastically changes the valuation by which the asset is valued, right? So this is a net operating income approach. So you take a nasty, empty big box retail building, you convert it to 500, 600, 700 climate controlled class A self-storage units. Obviously the net operating income per square foot shoots up, and the asset class conversion changes the formula by which the asset is valued. And all of a sudden, on average, we'll buy a building for a couple million. We'll put a couple million into it. Stabilized value will be somewhere in the $13 to $17 million range. The very unique thing about that is that then we are sitting typically at around 30 to 35% LTV. Like if you and I bought an apartment complex, we put granite, stainless steel, and we increase the rents, we're going to increase the value of the apartment complex by maybe 30%. So then to get our capital out, you have to liquidate the asset. Everybody gets a payday, right? But now you're still trading time for money because you're fixing them up, you're selling them, right? You're basically a house flipper. No offense to anybody that's doing that, but our strategy is a little bit different. If what we're talking about is true independence of purpose, which is financial, time, and location independence, you don't really get that way by selling assets unless you sell a ton of them, can save the money and put it in the bank somewhere. Because we typically land at 30 to 35% LTV, the unique thing is that we can refinance the properties, and we don't want to stress the asset, right? These are golden geese. Nobody wants to kill and eat the goose when you can live off the eggs. So we would rather refinance the asset to 55, maybe 60% LTV. That's going to allow us to have a return of capital to all of our investors, usually typically double their money, and have a couple million dollars for ourselves as well. The unique thing is when we pay people out by way of a refinance, it's not a capital event, which means it's non-taxable because we didn't sell anything. Their name is already on the deed. We just refinance. Same way if you pay off your house and you pull 400 grand out, you don't get taxed on that. It's not a capital gain. So because of the asset class conversion, it puts us at such a low LTV that we can typically pay our investors out with most of that. Obviously, some of it is coming by way of preferred returning cash flow, but the lion's share is coming by way of a refinance, which means it's not a capital gain, which means it's non-taxable. We then allow our investors to stay in. We have a long-term vision and a long-term hold. So even after we give them those short-term gains, the long-term hold means they're continuing to get cash flow moving forward. The property is being paid down as well, which means we're building equity with potential for a future cash event with another refi. And by leaving those investors in the deal, that's behind the name Nomad Capital, right? A nomad is somebody that can go where they want, when they want, and do what they want. And that comes from having a long-term vision and a long-term hold. If you and I, and talking about the reallocation of resources across the real estate space, let's say you and I wanted to go build a self-storage facility right now. We're going to pay, it's obviously market dependent, we're going to pay about $120 a square plus the cost of the land. So $120 a square foot for the construction plus the land acquisition. Our last six conversion projects that we did across North, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, and Eastern and Virginia, our average is $63.50 a square foot. And that's the day that we're done. We're there with the Chamber of Commerce, cutting the yellow ribbon. The doors are open and we're renting units out. We're at $63.50 a square. Plus, we typically have a 3 to 5 to 7 acre parking lot that we don't need that we can sometimes outparcel. So that combined with future opportunities to, if we want to put solar on a 90,000 square foot roof when the time is right in terms of the tax structure for that, it creates a lot of opportunity. The reallocation of resources, you know, Bed Bath & Beyond just went out of business. Kmart's out of business. There's Sears. There's, you know, there's a ton of buildings out there that were built in a time where people were driving to those locations to buy their goods. That may not be the case. But when it comes to self-storage, what really matters is about a 7-mile radius. That's about as far as people want to go. So a lot of those buildings, if they've been empty long enough, if you can get them cheap enough, and if you can do the construction yourself with vertical integration, meaning you're not paying retail costs for the capital, you're not paying retail costs for the construction or for the management, it gives us a very unique strategic advantage. I think we've got a pretty good runway before we get too much competition in that space, just because you really have to have that full vertical integration to make the risk worth the reward.
Yeah, no, I mean, this incredible strategy. And I think the adaptive reuse or asset conversion, I mean, I was heavily involved in, you know, hotel to housing conversion projects as well. So, you know, we like to use the term of cap rate arbitrage, where you're buying hotels at like a 12% plus cap rate, and then converting them into housing, which would, you know, have the cap rates anywhere between 4 to 6% generally, which obviously fluctuates over time, but there's always going to be that spread between hotels and housing. Same thing here with retail converted to self-storage. You know, one of the things with the asset conversion though, what is the process of rezoning? Have there been barriers there? Are you able to retain the zoning that it was previously under? What does that process typically look like?
Very intelligent question. And it's funny, this is the conversation where you and I originally connected. Like I speak with a lot of different investors on the phone, and you started talking about some of your hotel conversions. And I was like, hold on, wait a minute. I got to cancel my next call. We need some time here. So I have a lot of respect for what you guys have done, especially converting it to housing. Let's be honest. There's nothing that sexy about storage, right? We're renting someone a box of air. I think the way that we structure the business model is unique, but what you guys have done with hotel to housing conversions, like that takes some chops. So good for you. I'm excited to see more of your projects coming down the line. But in terms of zoning, one of the good things that we've run into, there is one town, actually my hometown, Lexington, South Carolina. We were working on the Kmart there. No money had gone hard, and the town, people were getting upset about how much storage was popping up in the area. And so they made a zoning change that new storage could only go into areas that were zoned industrial. That's the only example I have for you where that one, we put the brakes on it. We're like, okay, this one's not going to work, which is a shame for me. That was the Kmart I drove by on my way to high school every day growing up. So I was excited about that one. But with the exception of that, most of these buildings, you know, Kmart's, grocery stores, a lot of them across the Southeast are agricultural warehouses, like old cotton mills in the middle of a downtown right outside of Charlotte or Raleigh or Greensboro, someplace like that. There's a lot of those are maybe not fit for conversion to multifamily, but they do check the boxes for conversion to self storage. What we find is that most of the time the buildings have been sitting empty for so long that the town is just ready for somebody to do something, right? So, but by the time a project ever makes it to any of our investors, we've gone through the process of zoning, phase one studies, phase two studies, if we need to. We typically have, you know, $100,000 to $150,000 that have gone hard in that project before it ever gets to our investors. You know, there's asbestos and, you know, lead and whatever else there may be. There's a lot to navigate, especially with some of the older buildings, like late 1800s. But yeah, the zoning, we find that most of the time, the buildings that we're getting the best price on have been sitting there empty for so long that the town is just ready for someone to do something. And our strategy is typically very well received. And also, there's no speculation about why we're going there. We use third-party feasibility studies as well as in-house feasibility studies. There's solid growth in these markets. We're seeing younger generation, unfortunately, typically aren't buying houses, they're renting. They're getting pushed out of these urban areas into the secondary, tertiary markets where they can commute. And when they're renting by the space. So would they rather rent a two-bedroom condo for $1,800 a month or a one-bedroom for $1,300 a month and then get a storage unit for $150 and use it as an extension of the closet, as an extension of the garage? So we're following a need. We're looking for underserved markets that have that need in that area, and it's a very well-documented need. So for the most part, with that one exception, they're happy to have us, and we navigate the zoning issues with the town before it ever gets to our investors.
That's very helpful. What about financing? Like, what are the bank's general appetite toward your strategy? I'm assuming you're getting a hefty construction loan to buy the asset and then also pay for the construction. Or given these owners or sellers are probably pretty desperate to get this off their hands, you know, do you often use some kind of a creative financing structure? What does it typically look like?
So far, we're using everyone. We have a fund model now. So if we need to close a building with cash, we can close it with cash. Typically, what we're doing is we can still get pretty healthy lending. I mean, even within the banks, there's a couple things that they look at. Number one is if we're paying typically on a building that we're going to pay, if you're from the Southeast, which hopefully some of your listeners are, there's a soda called Sun Drop Soda. It's a facility we're going to be opening up in a few months. We bought the old Sun Drop Soda bottling facility in Gastonia, North Carolina, right outside of Charlotte. It's a 70,000 square foot warehouse that we're converting. It had been sitting empty for like 15 years before finally somebody was stupid enough to come along and buy it, which was us. When we bought it for $1.5 million and it appraised for $5.1 million, right? So a lot of times, like, there's just nobody that needs that much space. It's such a big building. But the way that we look at it, you know, the bank looks at it the same way we do. There's so much equity there right off the bat that they're willing to give us really good terms. On top of that, they know what we're going to convert it into, and that they know that that building is going to have a stabilized value of 15 to 17 million. So we're still getting, we're underwriting for 8.5%. The reality is, I think the last term sheet that we got for property we closed a couple months ago was 6.225. The banks have different bins of money they're willing to lend for different projects. Self-storage, they look at something that is traditionally inflation-resistant because we can change the rents on a month-to-month basis. The only commercial asset class that's more inflation-resistant than storage is hospitality, because Airbnbs and hotels can change their rent on a night-to-night basis. Self-storage, it's month-to-month. We're not locked into a 10-year triple net lease or something like that. So in terms of inflation-resistant, pandemic resistance as well, which we've just seen as well, and recession resistance, because it's typically a need. It's not discretionary spending for the most part. That because of that, they look at it as a very safe asset class and they're willing to work with us. And besides that, there's just so much equity in the project and what they know we're going to convert it into, that a lot of people, especially multifamily or even especially self-storage development right now, are slowing down. And we are on full-on acquisitions mode.
Yeah, no, that's great. When you guys are looking for new properties, you find yourselves competing with industrial operators, because you know, you keep hearing that the industrial sector continues to be hot. Vacancies are very low. You see a lot of headlines about the need for last mile distribution centers. So I imagine, are they also eyeing the types of properties that you're going for, or are these properties just they're not well suited for those types of needs, and the cost to convert them into some kind of an industrial use is not nearly as feasible or economically viable as it is for you?
It's typically more, not so much that they're looking at the projects that are great for us. It's that, you know, we cast a wide net and a lot of times we look at some of the projects that are right for them. Usually what they're looking for is, you know, ease to get in and out and highways and interstates and things like that. What we're looking for typically is residential density. We want a lot of people in a 1, 3, 5, and 7 mile radius. We want good traffic count, high visibility. We want to look at the average number of people per household, the average age, the median income, number of renters versus number of homeowners. Is the population rising? Is it falling? Make sure not too many people in one town work for one company that could leave town and drive people out. So a lot of the drivers that we're looking for, it's a kind of a microeconomy in a 1, 3, 5, 7 mile radius, whereas industrial would rather be out a little bit away. It's where they can get trucks in and out and kind of be away from that. We would rather have vehicle count and people coming by in a fairly densely populated area. So a lot of times we look at industrial properties. The reality is most of the time what we focus on is big box retail or agricultural warehouses where the town has grown around that area or old grocery stores.
Got it. Very, very interesting. So yeah, you're going out, you may be going after a similar asset class, but what you're optimizing for is a little bit different than what they're optimizing for in terms of the demographic and the location. You know, I was also going to ask that. Yeah. So what happens after you convert it? It sounds like you hold on to it, which I think is great. Makes a ton of sense. You know, so then there's the other half of the equation, which is the execution of the self-storage, you know, business. What is it that you think really differentiates you, Nomad Capital's approach to self-storage operations from the typical self-storage operator?
Yeah, in-house vertical integration. So my partners that I have, it's a father and son team of Eric and Levi Hemingway. They're the mastermind behind everything. I raise capital and help wherever I can. I help with some acquisitions and things like that. But they're the ones that, you know, spent their career swinging the hammers and really know how to get things done. So in terms of that, they have 4 self-storage facilities that they developed on their own before we started syndication. So the management was in place. We've got in-house property management that is these days, I mean, the same revolution that happened with the short-term rental space and electronic door codes and being able to change the code from one person to the other and things like that. And you know, app-based. The same thing has happened with self-storage. Within that space, one of the big questions I had for myself was within self-storage, is this asset class going away? Because you think baby boomers, Christmas decorations, China cabinets, or downsizing. So I was like, okay, is the asset going away? The answer is no, that it's not. It's not at all. And because the consumer changed, it changed the management style and the technology used for the management, which is to your question. The population is now the largest population segment in the country is millennials. Now they make up 34% of the population. They use 38% of self-storage, but they use it wildly different. Just like we talked about before, when they're renting instead of buying, the way they use storage is vastly different. They're using it as an extension of the closet, an extension of the garage. They still have stuff, but not as much stuff as the baby boomer generation. Their stuff is more activity oriented: mountain bikes, wakeboards, snowboards, kayaks, stuff like that. So these people, the traditional model of a self-storage facility that's open from 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and maybe 3 or 4 hours on Saturday doesn't work. These consumers need to get into the property, ease of access. They need to be able to get in at 6 a.m. on a Saturday, grab their snow bibs, a snowboard, and head towards the mountains, right? So because of that, the way they're using it differently changes the management. It's QR codes, it's touchscreen kiosks, ease of entry, get in and out, show up and rent a unit anytime, day or night. So our management style switched to more of a hub and spoke model where we'll have one person on site with a facility all the time, but they can manage 5 or 6 different locations. So a lot of times we'll have someone on site at a facility until we hit about the average self-storage facility is profitable. Their break even is usually between 60 and 65% occupancy. Ours is about 40% because of the low LTV and the low fixed overhead of the construction. But once we hit, you know, we're profitable, once we hit about 60% occupancy, so we've got a good margin in there, a lot of times we'll pull that person off and have them go manage another facility within an hour away, and we'll just manage that remotely. It drops the fixed overhead of that facility by $60,000 to $70,000 a year. So we can do everything with cameras, QR codes, touchscreen kiosks. The traditional multifamily apartment complex, of all your gross potential income coming in, about 70% of that is expenses. Landscaping, office staff, maintenance, 30% of that is your net operating income. With self-storage, it's the inverse. You typically have about a 30% expense ratio, 70% is your net operating income. And the longer you own it, that 30% shrinks down to about 19 to 20% because after you get full, you don't have to advertise as much. There's significantly less in and out because you just don't have as many people coming and going trying to rent units. And you can do it pretty much everything remotely. You have somebody go by once a week to sweep up, check, make sure all the empty units really are empty and ready for the next person. But besides that, everybody's got a phone in their pocket, touchscreen kiosk at the door, QR codes. You know, especially COVID really pushed a lot of people, the older generation that didn't want to use technology that way has been forced to over the last couple of years. So the management has gotten significantly easier. And obviously in terms of software and app-based programs, it continues to just get easier and cheaper.
Very helpful. So one of the things that you've talked about repeatedly is that, yeah, you're vertically integrated. You obviously have this network, you're casting a wide net. And you know, all of these things, just what they say to me is barriers to entry. You've created a moat, you know, and a hurdle for anybody that also would want to do this, at least in your market. Is that what you would say would prevent anyone off the street from saying like, hey man, like this sounds like not too bad of an idea. Maybe I try this as well. There's this, you know, abandoned mall in my town. You know, are there more people that are jumping into this space as well? Have you found other operators that are executing this strategy with success?
There's a few operators. We're certainly not the first to do it. We're the first in this part of the country that are doing it with kind of any real sense of velocity. I think that it really is like, if anybody wants to go do the strategy, I would just give a word of warning. There's a lot of pitfalls with the zoning, with the construction, especially older buildings. They obviously, the buildings weren't designed for this purpose. But with that in mind, it can be done. The problem is if you're paying retail costs for the building, you're paying retail costs for the capital or the hard money it's going to take to get it done. You're paying retail costs for the construction and you're paying retail costs for the management. You're talking about quite a few million dollars outlaid to make a pretty thin profit margin. And the question is the juice worth the squeeze? So there's an economies of scale of not just doing it once, but doing it a lot of times across a large footprint to really make it worth it if you were going to do it with paying retail costs for all those different, you know, line items. Outside of that, the vertical integration is the key, right? That's the number. We've been doing it for a couple years. We beat our 2-year goal of $100 million in assets under management. We beat that by a couple months. We're about 120 now and continuing to roll. We got a fund right now for the acquisition of 5 properties this year. We got a 5-year goal of $500 million and a 10-year goal of $1 billion. The reason we're going to get there is because of the vertical integration. There's going to be more competition in the space. The beautiful thing is that what really matters to us is about a 7-mile radius. And I would say that it's a lot, right? My partners make it look very easy because they're very good. The reality is it's not. It's wildly challenging and it can be very risky. Again, there's a difference in risk and calculated risk. But that strategic advantage that we have, hopefully we've got another 6, 8, 10 years of full-on acquisitions mode continuing to move forward before we get too much competition in that space, because it's not easy and there's no small mistakes in this space, right? A little mistake across 97,000 square feet can easily be $500,000.
Thank you for sharing that. Well, you know, I think we're coming up on time, so I thought I just might wrap up with a few last questions. You know, what's your outlook for 2024? I mean, do you have a crystal ball? It's been pretty murky for me, so I'm wondering if you've had any better insight.
I wish I did. Luckily, within the market, I think we are still in a pretty good position with our relationships with the bank to continue to get funding. We always overwrite heavy on what the debt is going to cost. We typically were looking at a market at the average price per square foot for climate controlled self storage. We shave 15% off of that. We're running our numbers very conservatively. Everything is still telling us to move forward with acquisitions mode. One thing I would say for anybody out there looking to invest with anyone, if you haven't learned this already, you will soon, is be wary of variable rate debt. We don't use any variable rate debt. We never have. Luckily, our buildings are so cheap. We're typically buying a building just for a couple million dollars. It's not like I'm raising $60 million at a time. So because of that, we get off a little bit easy, but be wary of variable rate debt. because it's going to leave a lot of people exposed in the long run. And more than ever, don't look at the deal as much as looking at the operator. And market saturation. I think most multifamily outfits are slowing down big time. We still have a housing crisis. People still need a place to live. Within the syndication space, the sentiment has been and remains to try to stay alive till 2025. I think we're positioned well. We're moving full speed ahead. But if you look at the landscape as a whole, everybody is saying stay alive till 2025. And just be in a position where, you know, if you can make deals work right now, once you're in a position to refinance, it's going to be a beautiful thing.
Well said. How, if at all, can the Pixels and Properties community help you and your near-term goals?
I appreciate that. First of all, the number one thing, the way that we grow, we're a 506B syndication. So the way that we grow is just through word of mouth. We tell people what we do or what our strategy is, what we've done in the past. The best thing is just give us an opportunity to chat. That's the number one way that we learn and get better is by speaking with other people. So I host a podcast, which I can't wait to talk you into being on one of these days, called Truly Passive Income. Besides that, we're at nomadcapital.us. People can reach out to me directly at Clint, C-L-I-N-T, at nomadcapital.us. I spend all day talking to investors like yourself, and I love it. And it's a choice for me, and it's what I would be doing if I could do anything, because I can, and this is what I'm doing. So I love it. I love the opportunity to connect with anybody who has interest in what we're doing.
Well, thank you, Clint. This was an awesome conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, man. Really appreciate your time.
Take care.